cliffcentral.com.
It's the Beatles with Golden Slumbers. Love this song to pieces. All right, so let's get on with it because we have much to cover this morning. Anthea, who's been on how many flights? Four flights. And you were in Neisner and you spoke to the suspicious Austrian man.
Indeed. So four flights in 5 days.
Oh, thanks.
Spoke at a at the book festival, literary festival in Neisner. So I don't know what. Hundreds of people.
Uh-oh.
And of course, shook hands with all of them, signed
Uh-oh.
Their books.
You're definitely a carrier. And she's coming in here like she's perfectly clear. She's going to pass
some
it on to us.
Some of those people have, in Neisner, some of those people have probably
been Italy,
like,
right?
Out there on the Alps and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Let me see. Is this, am I about a meter away from you?
Yeah, what's the social distancing required to stay away from Anthea?
I think Anthea must use that mic on the
Anthea,
outside of the studio.
I'm not that interested in whether you're contagious or not. What I'm interested in is your take on the markets. I mean, my God, we've had probably, this is the biggest crisis since 2008. It may even in some long-term way eclipse it, right?
Mm. Oh, definitely. So we're officially in bear territory, bear territory is defined by a 20% fall from the high. And all the major stock market indices have fallen that. So it's now a bear market. So what I was thinking before all of this was that we're in the late stage of a global economic cycle, which means that we're probably going to see some sort of slowdown in economic growth and a recession. But I was expecting that at the end of this year or maybe even next year. And what COVID-19 has done is just brought it forward, and brought it forward quite dramatically.
Are you saying that you were pricing something
so
as
we were
severe
expecting,
as this in?
No, definitely not. No, okay. Absolutely not.
My God, that would make you Nostradamus.
Exactly. And my crystal ball needs polishing. Mm. We were expecting a slowdown, and we were looking to move towards more yielding assets than risky assets. So we're talking bonds, money market instruments, rather than shares. And particularly, we were looking at staying away from shares that had weak balance sheets, because that's the real trick. And we'll get to that in a bit. But yeah, this has all been kind of so in the beginning, it was all, initially we thought, oh, the media is making too much of this. It's a one PE event, so one price earnings ratio event, and it's over, markets will bounce back, consumers will start buying, companies will generate revenue profit, and it's back to normal, right? But it hasn't happened that way. It really has been, as you called it, a shit show. Where I still think traders and investors have overreacted, mm-hmm. but it's not, It's irrelevant what I think, right? The market is obviously stronger than me or bigger than me. And so I don't think it should be as bad as this yet, but it is. And here we are today in a bear market. And now where to from here is the question, right? So the Fed, central banks have gone out of their way to cut interest rates and to pump easy money into the economy. So the US Federal Reserve 2 weeks ago cut interest rates by 0.5%, and then on Sunday night they cut it to zero. So rates in the US are now zero, and they're pumping $700 billion of easy money, we call it quantitative easing, into the system. Ideally, what should happen is that because interest rates are low and people are paying zero interest rate on their debt, so mm-hmm. no interest basically on their debt, they should have more money to spend. Banks with the $700 billion should effectively be supportive of businesses. But we saw in 2008, and this is the thing that really annoys me, in 2008, where government did quantitative easing, released all this money, bought bonds, put money into the banks, and the banks actually didn't effectively pass the money on. So they kind of kept it in their vaults, if you like, in theory, right? Because it's not that simple. It's a bit more complicated than that. It's not like you go to the bank and the bank, and you're a business, you go to the bank and say, well, I'm struggling, can you give me some money? That's not how it works.
Can I ask you a simple question, which may not be so simple, because I know some people who are really, really smart who've struggled to answer this, but it seems to me like an obvious and logical one. There was all this money in the system a little while ago. There was all this value in the system, right?
Yeah, I don't know how you're measuring that, but okay,
well, I mean,
go with it for now.
Let's say, for example, that the stock market was at, what, 28,000 or something, the Dow Jones?
Yeah.
So now all that value has been wiped. That money hasn't been destroyed. It's like energy. You can't destroy it. or make it out of nothing. It's got to have gone somewhere. Where is it gone? Where is this money? I mean, okay. Does that sound like a stupid question?
No, it's a very clever question, actually. Very clever. Let me explain. So when you say the Dow Jones or the S&P 500 is at this level and there's a whole lot of money in the system, that's paper money. Mm-hmm. So until you sell out of, let's say you own shares or units in the Dow Jones and it's at 30,000, until you sell it, you don't have cash. You don't have money. It's paper money. So you've made a paper profit. Then it falls to 20,000. You haven't lost any money. You've made a paper loss. You only actually see that loss when you do sell. So in 2008, I don't know what the level was. Let's say the market was at 25,000 in 2008. In October 2008, it fell by 40%.
It's probably around 20,000, I think.
It fell by 40%. If you had sold out then, you would have crystallized your losses. If you'd held onto your money 2 years later, you would have been at the same level and not even noticed anything, right? So this is paper wealth, really. 3 years later, you would have doubled your money. And I think that's very important to remember when you're thinking about the stock market and your pension fund and investing, because so risk...
Mm-hmm. Just like people panic buy toilet paper, which is stupid... You don't want to panic sell shares when the market's like it is now, because it's going to probably recoup its losses and recalibrate. And you'll be in 2, 3, 4 years maybe, if it's really bad, you'll be back where you were. Exactly. Only if you sell now are you in Stoch.
Exactly right. Only if you sell now do you crystallize your losses.
Okay.
And just, you know, so we all understand it the same way. When you say it's a paper loss or a paper gain, it's because it's not linked to anything. It's not linked to gold anymore. It's not linked to a thing that is a particular weight and size. It's linked to a dollar, which they can print more.
So it's linked to the value of the company that you're invested in. And the stock market always forward prices. So it always prices forward. So when I talk about price earnings ratio at 20 times, it means that if you buy a share for 10 Rand, it'll take you 20 years to get back in earnings that money, right? But the market always works like that. So it may not take you 20 years because there's a whole lot of other issues involved. And so inflation and increase in revenue, increase in profits, it may be 2 years, it may be 3 years, it may be 40 years if it's a bad company, for example.
Right. Now, let's speak about bad companies for a minute, because there are going to be some people who'd lose out tremendously from this. Here locally, we've seen some ugliness on Sasol.
Right.
I mean, what's happened
there? You want to talk about Sasol?
Well, yeah, I just think that we need to understand how the bottom of the barrel's looking, and then we need to look at companies. I just read a story about how Amazon is hiring 100,000 more employees, and they're putting in a higher wage for those employees, and they know that they're going to have lots more business because people are buying online, and they're buying their supplies, their basic needs, their food, their loo paper, things like that, that have obviously become matters of survival for some people.
So you've jumped the gun a bit, because the next stage of what we're going to talk about, so we've seen the market crash and we've seen an absolute disaster and everyone's panicking, and this panic selling is driving me insane. But what you should be doing is buying, right? Because when there is fear...
With what money is
that? and so that's the issue. If you had cash, if you had some cash, now would be exactly the time to be investing. And as I was saying, when we were rebalancing our portfolios earlier in the year, we actually ended up not sitting on cash, not as much as we would have liked, but certainly a little bit, so that we could start buying companies that we think have strong balance sheets. So I have such interesting conversations with my friends. One of them yesterday was saying, surely we should be buying Adcock Ingram because they make Dettol, right? Dettol's their brand. But actually, Adcock Ingram, from a fundamental and analytical point of view, really has a weak balance sheet. It's indebted. And Dettol probably is not a huge generator of revenue for them overall. So that's probably not a good one. The next one everybody asks me about, everybody, including listeners, by the way, messaging me going, should I be buying Sasol shares now, last Thursday? I did buy some because I do think it's overdone. The inputs for Sasol are probably falling in price, but so is their output, their ability to be a price maker.
It's bottomed out.
I'm not sure it has. So what we're concerned about with Sasol is because actually, you know, this Lake Charles project, which they've spent, what is the number now? It's like a crazy billions of rands number, has unfortunately put them in a lot of debt. And so companies that we look for are companies with strong balance sheets, not a lot of debt. And Sasol suddenly is sitting on huge amounts of debt. And not only that, but if the banks, if they breach covenants, so if they fall below, I don't know, 100 rand a share or whatever, then the bank suddenly says, but actually the guarantee you gave us as shares is now worth nothing. It's 30 rand a share. You gave us a guarantee at 100 rand a share. We're going to have to call in this money. Sasol, so I think Sasol below 30 rand, I mean, I couldn't believe below 30 rand.
Sure.
Was scary because you didn't know if the banks and the lenders were going to then start calling in their debt from Sasol, giving back their guaranteed shares, or if they would give them an extension on this debt. And then Sasol on, I think it was Thursday afternoon, put out a statement, a rather arbitrary statement in my opinion, saying that they weren't breaching covenants and that they had until the end of June, and they renegotiated their debt until the end of June. Like, they didn't actually say anything tangible because initially we knew that at 800 rand a barrel of oil, that was kind of the absolute bottom where Sasol was in dire straits, breaching covenants and going to fall in a heap. But then they said something about 580 rand. We're still trying to figure out what Sasol are doing. But I think all they did on Thursday was just say to the market, oh, calm down. And then the market did, actually, because it's now trading at about, when I last checked, 40-something.
Right. They're going to talk to us about taste. I mean, they put out a thing.
Taste Holdings. Yes. I didn't see their SENS. There's so many SENSs going on at the moment. And the shame of it is, if you're a company reporting, like, you're just wasting your time, actually.
What was Taste? Voluntary liquidation.
Oh, are they now in voluntary liquidation?
Oh, wow.
I didn't actually see that because we don't have...
Oh, that's,
we don't cover it.
Domino's?
Yeah.
Who else is in the Taste group?
I think Fisherways, Steers, isn't that Taste as well?
I think, no, Steers is
famous.
Steers is famous. Famous.
Got them mixed up, right.
All right, so...
I'll find the sense
for you. Here's a basic question. Where can we put our money at the moment, other than in cash, which you said would have been preferable if you could go back and rewrite, let's say, the last 6 months? You take out some money and you put it into cash so that you can buy now while things are cheap.
Right.
But where, what, you would you buy? What would you buy? You've always told me you don't like gold. You don't see the point of gold.
Because you're not old.
Because I'm not a pirate.
What would you buy?
So I'm looking for companies that have strong balance sheets. And I do, I have bought Sasol, I
so
will
shares.
Admit.
Shares.
We're talking about shares, okay. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about shares for now. I think there are shares that have good value. Companies like Redefine, which is a property holding company, they're on a yield of over 20% now. You're not going to get that if your money sits in the bank. You know, your other option is just to leave it in cash in the bank or to put it in a money market account, which, by the way, is going to decrease in value.
If they drop interest rates.
If they drop interest rates, exactly. That's exactly right. So companies with strong balance sheets are where you're going at the moment. I don't think this is going to be a V-shaped recovery, you know. So we've crashed and I think we will recover, but I don't think it'll be sort of this is the bottom and off we go. I think we're going to sit at the bottom for a while. So there's actually no need to go and rush in and buy shares, right?
In other words, it's not going to suddenly drop into the bottom of the V and then hit the upshot straight away.
Exactly. And so if you're brave and if you don't have to withdraw your money, kind of sit it out. If you've got some cash, don't rush into it. Take your chances where you can. Look carefully at which companies you want to buy. We're looking at it now and we really are trying to fundamentally figure out what COVID-19 is doing to revenue, doing to earnings. We have no idea how long this is going to last. So I'm not panic selling and I'm not panic buying at the moment, kind of.
All right, so keep a cool head. Retail in this country looks like it could be an opportunity. I don't suppose that this panic buying is going to do any harm to the balance sheet of Woolworths, Macro, places like check is, Pick and Pay. They're probably benefiting from this.
Absolutely, yeah. So I was thinking exactly the same thing. But again, you know, our consumer is struggling, and a bit of panic buying raises your revenue for a couple of weeks, and then you're back to normal. So so from a macro point of view, the economy really is struggling, and this is going to hurt a lot of people. And my concern with consumer shares or retail shares at the moment is that what's going to come out of this in the next couple of months is more unemployment, small businesses going under, and, you know, consumers not being able to buy kind of as they should be, or as we like them to be buying. So would I be buying consumer shares right now? No. Okay. I really am not rushing into anything other than Sasol and Redefine. which sounds a bit crazy, but, you know, for me it was more of a trading option than kind of a long-term investment.
Well, here's an interesting question. And again, you know, we've got to be clear about this. Anthea is not giving you direct financial advice. She doesn't know what your current situation is, and there's no way that she can. She can't know what everybody's going through or how much everybody has. So you have to figure this out yourself or ask your own financial advisor. But this is general information that may be useful to people who just want to know how to navigate the economy for the next couple of months. So let's look at this question from LW, who says, "Hi, Anthea, if you're saying we should invest our cash that we have lying around, how much are we talking about? Is there a minimum amount that you should invest? Or should, I mean, I think you might have answered that by saying just take it easy.
Yeah, calm down.
you don't have to rush into things, right?
Absolutely. So the general rule of thumb, yes.
Sorry, these people who've shorted the market in the last couple of weeks must have made a ton of money.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely.
If you're a trader who's shorted certain stocks, you could have cleaned up.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt. Show me one, though.
you mean that very few people were...
There are very few people who would be net short the market, honestly. I think there were very, very few. I think what a lot of people have done, very like generically speaking, is panic sold and sold shares that actually had made them some money. You know, so if you were set on Naspers, for example, because there's a share you'd want to buy at these levels. There's another one, yeah. So Naspers. So if you'd held Naspers up to, I don't know, 3,000 and suddenly fallen to 2.5, but you bought it at 2, then of course you want to sell it when it starts falling, right? So I think that's what's happening. People are just trying to minimize their losses as the market fell. I'm not sure people were net short. Back to the question. Investing in shares versus investing in property versus investing in bonds is really a lifestyle model issue. So if you're younger, you really should take the chance and be invested in shares, because this is exactly what happens. You know, as I was going to say earlier on, risk to anybody. Risk really means that when the market hits these levels, you desperately need your money out. If you wait, as I was explaining earlier on, if you wait a couple of years, you'll be back to normal and you would have made more money. But so the problem here for us, because everyone here is like not even close to retirement age, is that if we desperately need cash now and we want to sell out of our pension funds or our shareholdings, then that's just crazy, right? You should really just sit it out and wait. If you do have cash, I would say, and you're youngish, and you're not going to need the money in 2, 3, 5 years' time, or even 7 years' time, then sure, I think you should probably be, and this is like a very generic academic number, but you should probably be 75% to 85% in shares.
Okay. That's quite a lot.
That's a lot.
Yes, because the stock market, believe it or not, generally returns
South African
better.
Stock market?
Not in the last 5 years, no, but over historically, over time, the stock market generally returns higher rates than any other asset class, most other asset classes you know, that you and I can access. There's also private equity, but that's another story. We're not talking about that today.
Okay. All right, well, let's talk about the world economy for a moment, because where is the money flowing, as far as you can tell, in terms of the world economy right now? Where is it all going? We know that people are emptying out the stock markets. We know crypto is terrible, but you've never really been a big believer in that. Gold, you're not a fan of. What's happening with oil, and how is that affecting things generally?
So oil has crashed and burned. I've never seen oil fall 30% in one day. I mean, these are unprecedented times. So I'm not sure that the money is going anywhere. When you say, where is it going? You know, this whole idea that the stock market and investment is a paper profit or loss until you crystallize it really is kind of what it is. Like, I think so if you have a company that sells toilet paper, right? Mm-hmm. And we expect this company to grow. And so let's say every year it's making $100. And then because of COVID-19, it's making $120. But then guess what? In June, it'll go back to making $100. In fact, it probably won't. It'll go back to making $80 because people have stockpiled and so they're not going to buy. I think COVID-19 is not necessarily a supply issue. It's a consumer issue. Okay. And all we're doing is consuming right now, right here at this point, and then stockpiling and then not necessarily having to consume or buy later on. Humans don't consume more toilet paper just because there's a virus, right? So kind of those
not
stockpiles.
Not this virus.
Exactly. And so those stockpiles you're going to have to use. And so the toilet paper making company in June suddenly won't make the revenues it was making before the virus happened. And what we're trying to do as investors is figure out kind of which companies are going to survive. That's your first thing. Because in 2008, if you'd been invested in the South African stock market, everybody who was invested in 2008 made money, right? Has made money now. There were no companies that went bankrupt in South Africa. Overseas, yes. This time it may be different. I think we've got listed companies that may not survive this time around.
Right.
And it's all about understanding where the revenue and the earnings and the profit is going to be. And there's actually no way of telling. There's no way of knowing what's going to happen. I mean, I don't think it's as simple as saying, where is the money flowing to?
Well, what I'm asking then is that the model that we had up to yesterday, I mean, when I say yesterday, I mean like 2 months ago when this whole COVID thing started, is that there were raw materials mostly, which were our exports. We had some manufacturing, although that wasn't where we wanted it to be. I'm talking about the South African macroeconomy. We had massive pressure. We're in a technical recession, blah, blah, blah. Are any of those fundamentals going to change tremendously? Because once everything's reset, once everything's sorted out, once we've got a handle on this pandemic, do you reckon it'll go back to where it was?
That's what I'm trying to figure. I'm trying to figure out where it's going to go back to after this. And I don't think it can be the same. I think lots of things are going to change. For example, airlines are going to go bust. Consumers are going to go bust. Small businesses are going to go bust. And employment is probably going to increase. So
Unemployment.
And so I don't think it's going to go back to where we were. I think we're going to go back to more or less where we were, but at a lower level.
Oy, oy, oy.
Mm. Well, it has to, right? Are you spending money on flying? Are you going to hotels, having holidays? You're not spending as much as you normally would. My life has come to a standstill.
Yeah, but also, I mean, so China announces this like decline of theirs in their earnings. So China's in their
GDP.
Growth. In their growth for the first time in I don't know how long. They're saying
they've revised it down, yeah.
Down by 1%, which for China it's like huge. And
which part is huge? The fact that they're being honest and they're revising their earning or their growth expectations lower?
Revising their growth expectations. Yeah. And I think for people like us who are selling a lot to the Chinese, it has an impact.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And so this is the problem, right? So we're not going to go back to the levels that people were buying. So companies that were producing and selling to China are not going to make the same revenues.
Like,
chances are they're going to have to lay off people.
Like Kumba Iron Ore, for example. We're seeing a decrease in demand in the short term,
yes,
probably even the medium term. And that's going to then affect a major part of our economy in terms of iron ore production.
So the shame of South Africa is that while the rest of the market was booming, growing, we pretty much stayed flat. And now we haven't taken advantage of the global economy kind of boom. And now that things are slowing down, it really is going to impact us very negatively. And I'm sorry it's such bad news. Like, it really is quite horrible news. And this whole COVID-19 has triggered, because normally it was going to happen anyway. We knew it was going to happen. We knew there was going to be a global slowdown in economic growth. But the fact that it's kind of, it's been squashed and focused, you know, being very pointed in the last 2 or 3 months, just means that we're now going to be in a recession for longer than, or more of a recession. And I don't want to say depression. First of all, there's no academic definition of depression. Recession is 2 negative growth quarters. So I think, you know, maybe we have 4, 5, or 6, 8 negative growth quarters in South Africa. Yeah, unfortunately, that's where it is.
So what does a person like me or Sia do where, you know, for especially freelancer type individuals who may not have been, you know, quite as consistent in kind of pension fund and those money instruments and all of that. What happens now kind of in this environment, and you don't have a lot of cash to put to buy Sasol's shares? What's the best plan of action?
So from an investment point of view, I would say do not crystallize your losses. Don't sell. Don't withdraw money from your investments now. It is the worst time to do it. Sit through it. It's hard, sure, because really, if you're not getting work, you need to get cash from somewhere. You need to make money, and you'll be tempted if you've got some sort of small investment to withdraw it, but it really is the worst time to withdraw it.
Yeah. This is where there'll be blood. All right. Well,
Tears.
Do you have anything positive to share with us before we dismiss you on your merry way to home isolation?
The petrol price is going to come down.
Yeah, that's good news.
Yeah, but we can't go anywhere.
And hopefully.
Good point.
And hopefully, fingers crossed, everybody, that when the Reserve Bank meets, they will finally realize that they absolutely have to give us a huge interest rate cut.
Like what, 200 basis points?
You're kidding. Do you know our Reserve Bank, Gareth? Come on. You know they 100? Are such hawks.
How much?
I think this is like drawing blood from stone. I think they should do a full percent or even 1.5%, but there is no chance. I know those governors, and they'll probably... I think we'll be lucky if we get half a percentage point. Half a percent.
It's gonna make a difference. People need help.
Exactly. People. So there's two things, really.
And look, here's the problem with those guys, right? Is that our Reserve Bank have said it is not their job to stimulate the economy. It's their job to make sure that we are competitive inflationarily. Mm. Now, because of that, their policy and their monetary policy commission is the bigger economy is not just our responsibility, and actually, even though we hold all these cards, we can't be responsible for making those big decisions about the economy at this point. It's not our job. But they need to.
They absolutely need to. And I think government really shouldn't interfere with the Reserve Bank. They're supposed to be independent, blah, blah, blah. But they must realize that by making a huge cut in interest rates, they're really helping the consumers who are sitting there going, oh, well, I'm not getting as much work. I don't have as much cash coming in. I can't go out. I can't spend. But if, you know, my debt decreased every month, payments decreased every month, then maybe at least I'll be okay and I don't have to withdraw my pension fund. So, yeah, I think, one, the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England have made a mistake by cutting their interest rates, because when they're going to need it, they have no... They've used up their arsenal.
Yeah,
they've got no stimulus left. But we're not in the same position in South Africa. We have fairly relatively high interest rates. We do worry about exogenous factors on inflation, but hey, the oil price is down, so we're going to be okay for the moment. And so, yeah, they should really take this opportunity to do something about it.
But the president did allude to some kind of stimulus, even though we don't know what it looks like. And now that Tito's been banned from tweeting, we'll never know what he's thinking.
Has he been banned from tweeting? Fantastic. And
you're
talk about Tito.
That.
At the moment, I'm very happy. Like, I'm so done with sardines and weed on his farm.
Marcus says, Anthea, I'm rubbing my hands together for when the bottom of the market comes. When do you think that will come? I'm ready to buy.
I don't have a crystal ball, Marcus.
Okay,
but
sorry, Marcus.
You know, there's another saying in the market. We do love our sayings in the market. Mm-hmm. Only monkeys pick bottoms. And so we don't know where the bottom of this market is, but it's as close as damn it. So if you excuse my language, but if you are going, if you've got cash and you want to buy and you are rubbing your hands together, then yes, you know, now is a good time to start looking at the Sasols, the Redefines, the Naspers, which are not going to go under.
Right.
And they may come off another 5-10%, but, and they may stay where they are for another year, but you don't know where the bottom is, so don't try and pick it. Just slowly start building up your portfolio.
Right. Is it worth looking at at Bidvest? They've just made a big acquisition in the UK that's in the hygiene and biggest cleaning company, I think, in the UK that they've made. And I mean, Steiner, you know?
Yeah. It depends on what part of their revenue. It's the Adcock Ingram Dettol story. So Bidvest, I like Bidvest and I like Bidcorp. I like both of them, actually. I think I prefer Bidcorp more than I do Bidvest, but Bidvest, of course, will benefit from this weaker rand. So they make earnings offshore, and as the rand weakens, their revenue increases automatically, almost just by the exchange rate.
Exchange.
So yes, definitely at this stage, a decent company to go to buy. For me, Bidvest is probably more of a trading opportunity than an investment opportunity. So yes, buy some, and then in a couple of months when you've made your money, relook at that particular share.
All right.
And Bidcorp, you like it more?
I do like Bidcorp. Just because of its diversification and the earnings that it grows here rather than the risk of offshore investments.
All right, one last thing. This is an email I've just got now from Barrister Tony Manasa, principal attorney in Lomé, Togo.
Okay.
I know you're going to be all up for this.
Now I'm.
So, my dear.
Oh,
fabulous.
No, guys, just give me a second here. I believe this guy, right?
Dear.
I am Barrister Tony Manasa. I am attorney at law. I'm seeking your confidence to apply for the deposit claim inheritance fund of my late client, a national of your country who lived here in Lomé, Republic of Togo, for many years, until he unfortunately died with his entire family in an auto crash. Are you following?
Mm-hmm.
He bears the same surname with you.
Oh, Cliff.
I have searched for his family relatives to repatriate his estate, but to be unsuccessful. Hence my contact to you is for you to stand as heir apparent next of kin and receive his estate valued at $4,500,000, which he deposited in a bank before his death. Could you be able to receive the above sum into your bank account?
Of course you could.
I should, right?
Send him your bank details now. In fact, send him the password so that he has no issues when he goes to the bank.
Sure. All right. I think that's obviously when you must be especially careful is at times like these. There are a lot of sharks running around. We know that there are lots of people pretending to be medical experts going door to door to give tests and then they rob you. Please be very,
I saw that
very
and
aware.
I thought these guys, Mudimu, they are quick, eh?
Mm. Please be very aware of scams and criminals right now. Oh, we've got a brilliant deal for you on this. We've got a great once-off opportunity on this. Don't fall for that stuff, please. Also, don't fall in love with someone on Facebook or Tinder or Instagram at the moment, because there are a lot of people who are desperate and will promise you the world.
The disappointment.
Why, has it just happened for you, Sia?
Anyway, I like the weather. Do you like the weather? Okay. That's so cool.
All right. Don't fall for the crap, please, everybody. Thank you very much. Thank
Cheers,
you, Anthea.
Guys.
All right.
Bye.
Sure. Well, a lot to chew on.
I'm very excited that we are going to bring you the first episode in season 3 of Blind History next, which is very exciting. Pumelelo, you're going to come with me and do some shopping just now?
Absolutely.
I'll bodyguard.
Including like, where that, like rubbing alcohol.
I'll bodyguard you. You bodyguard me. Okay. We'll fill that trolley up.
Boom.
Take it all home. That's the way we're going to operate this morning.
Please. And we're in close proximity to all the big ones. A Checkers, a Woolworths, and a Dis-Chem.
We can hit all of them. We can go and hit them all. Take home 7 trolleys full. All right, very
while
good.
People are sleeping.
Oh, all right. So many things to consider this morning. So here it is. Episode number 1 of season 3.
Yay.
And you've got to listen all the way to the end of this Blind History podcast to hear an extra amusing fact. We'll have one in every episode. It's Anthony Medera, the MD of Taylor Blinds and Shutters, who you know have been a big supporter of Blind History. They were the guys who came up with the idea with me for this series. It's been our most popular podcast so far by a mile, and today's no different. We're looking at the 3 great Greek philosophers, Socrates, Aristotle, and Plato, the fathers of Western, if not world, philosophy. Despite us knowing so little about their lives, they have an enduring influence on every aspect of our thinking and understanding. I mean, Bulelo doesn't spend a day not thinking about Socrates or Plato or Aristotle.
This is true.
The university, the academy, the school, these things all come from great philosophers, men who actually lived and who knew each other. And it's time we get to know them. That's this episode. This is a whole new series. So we've got, I think there are 4, 8, 12. I think there could be 13 episodes in this series. Some of your favorite people. We've taken your suggestions, by the way, in compiling our list of who we need to cover in Blind History this time. So I hope you'll enjoy this season as much as the others. All right. We will see you tomorrow after this episode of Blind History. We've got lots of other good stuff, including Alan Ford on his show Spotlight. Yes, I know everybody's excited. You're all waiting for that. He's got how many guests today? 500.
Only four?
I'm squeezing 4 guests into 1 hour. But that's very little for Alan. Usually it's about 12.
With instruments.
We love instruments, Alan. So stick around for that and a whole lot more on cliffcentral.com. We will see you live tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. If you've watched Monty Python or seen the movie Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, or heard the one about Socrates on the bookshelf, you'll know that these days, Greek philosophers are portrayed as comedic figures, made to be the butt of jokes. But Socrates, Aristotle, and Plato are, of course, much more than that. They are the fathers of Western, if not world, philosophy. Despite us knowing so little about their lives, they have an enduring influence on every aspect of our thinking and understanding. The university, the academy, the school, these things all come from the 3 great philosophers, men who actually lived and knew each other. It's time we got to know them. We are back with another season of Blind History. When Anthony and I were talking about what we were going to do here, we thought, oh, it's going to be months away. It feels like it's all just suddenly arrived. So today, the episode that we're getting cracking on is the 3 great Greek philosophers. And we decided to lump them all into one episode because while they're all fascinating people, I'm sure you'll agree, there's not enough substantial biographical information for us to be able to talk about each of them individually in an episode. So it's almost worth rolling them into one because they are all related as well. And just before we even get started, was there a favorite one among the 3?
I'd probably say Plato.
And then really? Why?
It looked like he had it more together. I think that Socrates was a bit crazy, you know, so he was maybe a little bit cooked, possibly. So I'd probably say Plato. And then Aristotle, I think he's probably the one that's in the Western world they probably lean on the most, and actually around the world. Yeah. But yeah, I just enjoy Plato. And Plato, the big claim to fame is the university sort of startup. So yeah, that piqued my interest.
Well, I mean, we'll start off chronologically and start with Socrates, who was the first one. He was born in 469 BC, and he actually started off as a stonemason. And he wasn't particularly well educated, which is why he's my favorite one of the 3. And he was a bit nutty. Mm. But the father of Western philosophy, really.
Correct, yeah.
And in some ways, you know, his famous line, "Know thyself," is kind of a guiding philosophy of mine. throughout the whole of your life, your purpose is to try to understand that life and to try to understand yourself. And I've always thought that that was very powerful, just those two words, know thyself. It was eventually those two words that were carved onto the entablature of the Temple of Delphi. So it became kind of the guiding philosophy of the ancient Greeks and the Romans, Stoics and the teachers of the ancient world. But Socrates was very bizarre. He also fought, didn't he fight as a soldier in the Peloponnesian Wars?
Yeah, so his parents, people say that they were very poor. They were sort of medium poor, if that's even a term.
In the ancient world, that there's a difference.
Yeah, yeah. So, which allowed them to send him to the army. And everybody had to go to the army from the age of 18 to 60 odd. You know, they had to really serve time whenever necessary. And,
well, listen, they weren't messing around. Those Peloponnesian Wars were quite vus.
It was against the Spartans. Mm. And the Spartans, you know, there's a long history about how they lived their lives. But anyway, so he went and he was impressive. He was fearless and very much the way he lived his life. And you can see definitely in the end at his trial, absolutely fearless. And it's ironic. He saved the life of a great general, a very popular general.
Oh, yeah?
During the Peloponnesian Wars. And this particular general was one of many that stood against him at his trial.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it was quite...
Even though he'd saved him?
He saved his life in the Peloponnesian Wars.
And ungrateful son of a bitch.
Yeah, and he was one of the main instigators of taking him down.
You know, we're kind of circuiting around to the death, but this was a life well lived. He always said an unexamined life is not one worth living. Again, that philosophy of know thyself, which I think is so powerful. But we don't have any actual surviving accounts of his life or of his own writing him.
So he didn't note anything. I think he was just famous for just asking questions and then actually pulling the answer out of his audience. I mean, it was phenomenal. That was what they called the Socrates method.
Yeah, that's right.
And it also, it upset a lot of the nobility.
Well, he would question everything. I mean, he wasn't particularly trepidatious around things like gods and mythology and stuff that was very sacred to the Athenians and to the Greeks at large. But also at that stage, Athens was quite an open-minded place compared to the rest of human history and what came after. And I think he used that to his advantage. It was Periclean, true democracy. Everything was decided by an actual, you know, democracy meant everyone pitched up and they would decide stuff together.
Yeah, the men.
It's incredible. Only the men.
Only the men.
Only the Athenian citizenry and the nobility, by the way. But it was still democracy of a very pure kind. But I remember a story someone told me about how Socrates, when he was giving a lecture or he was talking about something or he was extracting questions and answers from people, if someone started applauding or the crowd got very excited about something, let's say they'd made some breakthrough in answering a question with some philosophical answer that people liked, if they started applauding, he would leave because he didn't like the idea of them liking the answer more than the process. Very pure guy in that respect, but he was a real hippie, right?
He was on the streets. That we got from Plato was what he looked like. He was short, stocky, bulging eyes, snubby nose.
Didn't sound like a good looking
guy. No, and then when he walked around, you know, with dirty clothes, unkempt, dirty fingernails. And at the time, you talk about Athens. Athens was the place to be. There was philosophy, poetry. It was just an incredible place. But beauty of being. Everybody that was admired were these athletes with oily skin and shiny skin, should I say, rather. And I think the oil came later. But
and he was a mess.
Yeah, he was a mess.
But I mean, even if you see those busts of his, and I saw two of them in Rome when I was there last year, they don't really portray a very nice-looking man.
No. And he always looked like he was stuck in a stare because he had those eyes. So obviously, I think that if we lived in that area, we might have thought, it's, you know.
But he used to say a lot of things that I suppose we've carried through into modern wisdom, and they sound like very profound things now, but I'm sure they were when he said them.
Yeah,
things
definitely.
Like, the only wisdom is knowing that you know nothing.
Yeah.
You know, 100%.
And
a lot of older people say that stuff to you, and you don't get it when you're young.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, he had a wife, Xanthippe.
One of his colleagues, I would imagine, said that she was undesirable. That's how he described. But Socrates also had three children, and what upset her was she just said, you're fiddling around with this blah, blah, blah stuff and nobody's paying for it. Yeah. Why don't you go and do some stonemason work?
Right, and bring home some bacon.
So she was upset with it.
But she was apparently a real shrew of a woman. And when he was asked about her, he said, because she was so unimpressive, he said, a horse trainer has to practice on the most spirited animals.
Yeah. You see, that's so excellent.
They were not nice. They were not nice about each other.
Yeah, they weren't.
Like any good married couple.
But the thing with what is interesting was that he didn't spend any time with his three sons. He didn't connect with them. He spent most of his time bringing up young boys in Athens. They used to mentor.
Yeah.
And they loved him. And he was pure. And if we try and put ourselves in the way the world was then, I mean, these gods could kill us. Mm. I mean, that's how scary it was. You could be struck down by lightning. And what he would say is we need to move away from that part of your life and look at more in ethics. So you've got to look at ethical rule or ethical behavior rather than the theological side of the behavior that was driven at the time. Those are massive risks that he took.
Well, those risks got him into trouble in the end.
Yeah.
Because he was eventually tried. There were about 500 people in the trial and about 280 said, no, he's guilty. 220 said he was innocent.
Mm.
So he lost by the narrowest of margins. But it was basically for refusing to acknowledge the gods. Those weren't really fair charges. They were all trumped up.
Yeah, they were trumped up. And I think that ultimately these windbags, as they said in one note, they wanted to take him out because he made them look stupid. At the trial, the fearlessness came out. He stood up and he made a mockery of the people questioning him. And that probably also put the knife in him, you know, although he was poisoned with hemlock. But ultimately, in the end, they said, you call me an atheist, but I believe in a God.
Mm.
So what is that? And then he says, I corrupt who is looking after the cause of the youth? And they couldn't answer the question. The laws. And then who writes the laws? And in the end, he pushed the people questioning him. They were really backed in a corner. They actually looked quite stupid. And then finally, when it was 280 to 220, you get a second opportunity. First of all, the accused has a chance to plead his case. Subsequent to that, they can do a revote. And he could plead the case that he apologizes and maybe he can go into exile or he's willing to pay money. I can't remember the exact currency, but he said he's prepared to pay one, whatever the currency is. And that was actually laughing at them because it was like offering a rand.
So, and he refused to apologize.
He refused to apologize.
Even though his rebuttal is called an apology in modern language. But he decided, screw you guys. Mm. It's not worth putting up with this nonsense. I'll take the poison. Mm. I'll drink hemlock.
Yeah.
Exactly went off right. and had some poison.
Yeah, he had to wait a month because they had some story going. You know, there was some religious story that there was some god that was killing young boys. And so they had to send boys for sacrifices and that had gone for a month. So they had to wait. And then they came back. And during that time, Plato and them had organized. They had money to bribe the gods. And we can get you out of here now. And he said, no. And I think that's where he made the statement about his life. And it's just not worth living. If it's, you know, he has to stand up for what he believes in. And Athens was his city.
Now, Plato came after him, but he was also his student, right?
Correct,
and he wrote
yes.
most of what we know about Socrates, including what you said about the way he looks. He was massively influenced by Pythagoras and established one of the first real schools in the
Correct.
West. It was called the Academy because it took place, the lessons would take place, the discussions, the conversations would happen in a place called the Academia, which was land that used to supposedly belong to Academus back in the days.
Yeah, that's correct.
So this is the first school.
Yeah, it was like a tertiary education.
Yeah.
It survives 3 centuries. And then our dear friend Sulla, who came before Julius Caesar and Augustus, he came and just destroyed it.
Wiped it out.
But it lasted for 3 centuries. And so many famous philosophers, such as Aristotle, came to Plato's academy.
Now, also, they had mathematics there. They taught literacy. And he was really recognized, Plato, as the first utopian thinker. I mean, he would think of metaphysics and epistemology and that kind of thing, which are matters of ethics and virtuism. And he wrote 36 books. All of them are dialogues in which Socrates features quite prominently as the protagonist. He devoted his life to one goal, which was helping people to reach something called eudaimonia or fulfillment. Mm. I mean, that's quite extraordinary.
Is this
one of the reasons you thought that he was more together than the others?
Well, I suppose he talked to me more. You know, I think it just made so much more sense. You know, there's no doubt that Socrates was incredible and Aristotle, but if we can just see something that makes so much sense, wise men talk because they have something to say, where fools talk because they have to say something. So, I mean, it just makes so much sense today. And you must realize we're talking 2,500 years ago. in a completely different society, and it talks to us. I just found that amazing. And then also he was broad in what he did in philosophy and all the things that he added to it. So such as Pythagoras, yeah. He loved the numbers. He loved the math side of it.
Yeah.
So there was a lot more to him. But interestingly enough, if you look at Plato, Plato was a wrestling champion.
Huh.
He'd won 2 tournaments, and if he won the 3rd tournament, he would go to the Olympics. And, you know, you would get food for the rest of your life. You'd get a meal for the rest of your life. The previous tournament he won a massive bottle of olive oil, which he couldn't finish himself, so he distributed, and that's how they made money. And he was, compared to Socrates, he was this proper Greek god-looking athlete. And interestingly enough, he overtrained. His coach said, no, listen, do not train today because you're fighting tomorrow. He didn't do that, and he lost that and didn't get into the Olympic Games. And that stuck with him so that when he'd already retired from wrestling, one of the great Greek wrestlers for the Olympic Games, he said to the trainer, who was a god in training and a famous general, he said to him, you're overtraining your subject. And the guy was mad with him. But then he told the story and it made sense. So he was very much about looking at the physical side and looking after the physical side and also looking after the mind. So basically, if you only look after the physical side, your mind is gone. You're an idiot.
Hmm.
But if you look after your mind and not your body's not going to last with your mind.
Yeah.
So he spoke a lot about those.
It's amazing. It's sort of like he had some balance that the rest of us are still trying to attain.
Agreed.
And he had a lot of interest in the way things worked in government, obviously. He said that democracy needed to be reformed. He said people should be only allowed to vote once they are philosophers. And he said that philosophers should be kings. And
no surprises there.
Kings should be philosophers.
Yeah, but he meant it deeper, but I was being a bit cynical, but that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I wish we could have more of that.
Well, Socrates, he was worried that people would be easily persuaded by someone charming and populist, and we deal with that today even.
All the time.
Than by someone who was really thoughtful and who meant well and who wanted to dedicate themselves to service.
Yeah.
It's much easier for humans to become enthralled by someone who just talks a good game.
Mm.
Well, that brings us to Aristotle, who's the last of the three. And Aristotle trained under Plato for a while.
Yeah, it did.
Although they were actually quite competitive, right?
Yeah, they were. They're not sure if Aristotle left Plato's academy to start his own because he felt he was snubbed when Plato passed away. He thought he was going to take over. Because of his Macedonian credentials, if you can call it that, his parents. So they were born in northern Greece, but... Mm-hmm. His dad was in the medical field.
He was a royal doctor.
Yeah, he was a royal doctor for the Macedonian king. So he grew up in court in Macedonia. And so it could have been that as well, because there was a lot of sentiment, you know, after the Peloponnesian Wars, the Macedonians weren't necessarily always massively accepted, especially when Alexander died. So there could have been those reasons why he started his own school.
You mentioned his father being a royal doctor. There was also an interesting story about by the time that he'd developed his reputation as the man who knew everything, or the master, the philosopher, Aristotle was already in demand all over Greece. And Philip of Macedon, who was the father of Alexander the Great, said to Aristotle, come, I want you to teach my son. And he said, look, you conquered my little village. Unless you free all those people, that's my price. I'm not going to come and train Alexander. And Philip said, sure, released all of the people from his town. They went about their own business from there on in, and he dedicated himself to teaching young Alexander. And of course, we've covered Alexander in a previous episode, but there's no doubt that Aristotle's ideas played an enormous role in the way that Alexander saw the world.
No, definitely. That gave him balance. The Macedonians were brutal, hard-drinking warriors, where Alexander, he showed so many other sides of poetry and philosophy and all of those things. So Aristotle definitely played a part, although both of them never talked too much about their relationship, funny enough.
Hmm. There was probably a bit of competitiveness there as well. But they called his followers peripatetics because he would walk around. He would never sit down while he was lecturing.
Mm.
So they'd all have to walk with him. He'd just keep moving the whole time, which I suppose was also a different way of teaching and something we don't see too much of today.
You know, it's almost like we'd imagine Jesus Christ walking with his disciples. But then the Stoics, I never knew this because you hear these terms so often, but what is a Stoic? Well, it's a Stoic that talks while sitting down. So it's Stoic is stool. I mean, so you always hear these words.
Yeah, whereas peripatetic is the opposite than someone who moves around while they're teaching.
Exactly, yeah.
while they're talking. Now, he also used to focus on speculative philosophy, so logic, metaphysics, natural philosophy. He was very interested in the real world, physics, astronomy, geology, biology, psychology, and then practical philosophy, which included things like ethics and politics and economics. Mm. And I mean, this guy knew a little bit about everything.
Imagine measuring his IQ. If you look at what he did, if you look at his studies on the animals and the fishes, obviously he got it wrong sometimes, but how incredibly close he was when he talks about vertebrates, invertebrates, etc. I mean, it's just so on a practical
side. I mean, even the atom, the idea
of,
which wasn't his idea alone, but he expanded those ideas to the point where only many hundreds of years later would modern science actually catch up to the philosophy.
Yeah, 2,500 years ago, this guy. So that's why he blew people away.
Now, where Plato had the Academy, Aristotle had the Lyceum.
Correct, yes.
And in French, they still say lycée for school. But it was a direct competitor with Plato's school. And all of his books are actually lecture notes. They're not really books that have a thread.
Yeah, and it's quite difficult to put them together. So I think it was only in the Renaissance period that they started really putting it together in more clear form.
He asked a couple of big questions too, and they're questions that we continue to answer now. What makes people happy?
Mm.
What is art for? What are friends for? He thought that friendship teaches you what you ought to be, and that it is the best part of life to have friends, which I think is really beautiful.
And then purpose. I mean, you know that we talk about purpose now. That gives you happiness.
Absolutely. And I think after the death of Socrates and those charges, I mean, he was obviously born after Socrates died, but he wouldn't go back to Athens. And he said, lest the Athenians sin twice against philosophy, correct, I'll better get my backside out of here.
And that was when Alexander died.
Yeah.
Because then the shit was going to hit the fan. So he said, well, I'm out of here. He actually only died a year later, I think.
Yeah.
After he left Athens.
Out of the three of them and their contribution to modern ideas and philosophy and all the rest of it, is there any particular event or anything about their lives that strikes you that we would be able to associate with today, that we could think of ourselves in the same world?
You draw so much energy from their statements that they make. You know, you talk about the fools, you talk about all men are mortals. Greeks are men, therefore Greeks are mortal. The three, that's just simple, simple things. All three of them made such a difference to the Western world.
Reason.
Yeah.
Rationality.
All of that. Once again, I say, you've got to know what it was like to live in those times. And they weren't scared to say what they felt. You know, and the one statement I said, you know, and he was punished for death, Socrates. He said, the street corner philosopher made a career of deflating pompous windbags. You know, it's just...
Could anyone hope for more?
Yeah, exactly.
If someone said that about me at the end of my life, I'd think I'd done well.
You'd done well, 100%.
Deflated a few pompous windbags.
All three of them didn't give a shit about what nobility or who ruled the world cared.
Right.
That was amazing about them.
There's the three great Greek philosophers, and there were obviously many more, but I think that those three give you a good insight into what else there is. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. The next episode is the story of notorious dictator Idi Amin. Was Plato his real name?
No, it wasn't. It was actually Aristocles. Where Plato came from was its connotation about broad shoulders.
Oh, wow.
Had. Yeah. So obviously his wrestling days.
He said that you should let your lover change you, that it's a good thing to let your lover come into your life and you learn things from them, they learn things from you, and you change.
I don't know when in that part of his life he said that, because he also said love is a serious mental disease.
Cliffcentral.com